Tibeca,
the podcast for London lovers, Anglophiles, and critical believers. RevLab. Welcome to this episode of More Tibeca. I am Carla Mauron, the Reverend of the Swiss Church in London, and I am with Laureen Redding. We are two Swiss fellows in London, and we take you to our favourite places in the British capital. Hi, Laureen.
Hi, Carla. And once again, I think we're going to do a virtual tour. So we're recording in our living rooms, and we're going to visit the places with our mind and talk about, describe them to each other, to you listeners.
And today we are going once more to London's East End, where we have been before. Well, last time in real.
Yeah, it's one of my favourite places in London.
Yeah, me too. I think we're both East End lovers, aren't we? So no wonder that we're taking you back there today. And it's also part of London that is well known for its mix of cultures and its migration history throughout the centuries. In the 17th century, it was home to the Huguenot refugees. That was actually the first refugee movement coming into Britain, the Protestants in France who escaped Catholic persecution. And later it was also home to a large Jewish community, to the German community, and today there is a very large Bangladeshi community. And if you look at the different places of worship in that part of London and the state they are in and how they're used, you will see that whole story from the past 100 years. But today we're not going to a place of worship, but Laureen is taking us to a famous art site, which also has something to do with the Jewish community. So Laureen, where exactly in the East End are you taking us today?
Yeah, I'm going to take us to a historic place. More specifically, it's a street called Cable Street, which is in the heart of the East End. It's a small road that goes along the arches where the railways go across, the DLR. And more specifically, I'm going to show you all a mural. So that's a big painting on the side of a house. So it's really, really big. And it shows the Battle of Cable Street.
That almost sounds like the Battle of Hastings, some historic battle. How historic is it?
So it's very historic, but it's not a battle between armies from different countries, but it's a battle between the police and the fascists and the local residents that lived along Cable Street back in the day, the ones you mentioned earlier. So you can see on the mural, it's a huge sort of street battle with police on horses. There are furniture blocking the street. There are local residents throwing things down from their windows and protesting against the fascists. And that's the history of it. So in the 1930s, in England as well as in other countries in Europe, there was also the rise of fascism and National Socialism. In England, there was a politician called Oswald Mosley who founded the British Union of Fascists. So these were super right-wing, they were very sympathetic to Hitler and the German National Socialists. And in order to show their power, they organized a march through East London, which was a particular provocation based on what you said before. You know, that's a very melting pot. A lot of a big Jewish community lived there as well, a lot of immigrants. And they wanted to march through there to show their power. And they announced they were going to do it on the 4th of October, 1936. And when the local residents heard about this, they decide they're not going to take this. They're not going to be intimidated or afraid, but they're going to block this and stand their ground. And so it happened that on that day, when the fascists were trying to march through it, all the people who lived along Cable Street and in the surrounding areas, together with dock workers from Ireland, with communists, Labour Party members, trade unionists, and of course a lot of the Jewish community who lived around there, came together and blocked the street. So as it shows in the mural, they put all sorts of furniture and cars and everything to stop the march from going through. And the police actually tried to remove that blockade. And that was also part of the Battle of Cable Street, when the local residents, you know, stopped the, not only the fascists, but also the police who tried to remove the obstacles and get the protesters out of the way. So that is a very impressive part of that history. And that shows on that mural.
It's interesting how I first heard about the Battle of Cable Street, because in London, it's a really big thing, isn't it? It's a historic event that most people know about. And my husband had his sound studio in Cable Street. So I have a personal connection with that as well. And I think quite early in our relationship, he told me about that Battle of Cable Street in a way, presuming that everyone knows about it. And I said, what is this Battle of Cable Street? So it is a big part of London's history, isn't it?
Yes, definitely. And I think it's particularly powerful, and I'm so impressed by that story. And you know, when I walk or cycle through that through Cable Street past the mural, I'm always like thinking of that history, because it's really, you know, what stopped the fascists. So they didn't go through. They had to stop their march, go somewhere else in London, and it was eventually the beginning of the end of fascism in the United Kingdom.
And so what is the story behind the mural? What can you tell us about that, also from like as a piece of art or as a memorial site?
Yeah, so the, as I said, that was in 1936, then there was the Second World War, and then only later in the 70s, the history of the East End of Cable Street was really, thought about and tried to bring that to the people in art as well. So in 76, Dan Jones, who was the secretary of the Hackney Trades Council, so like a local organization for Hackney, which is where the mural in the East End is. And Dan Jones saw that a mural would be a good idea. And so he tried to find an artist who would like depict this amazing event, the Battle of Cable Street, in the actual Cable Street. So he found that side of the house where he could put it, where it would be perfect to put a big painting on. And he also found an artist, Dave Binnington, and they started working on it. They got the permission and they started working on it. And sadly, it wasn't always easy. So during the time when it was painted, there was at some point an attack where they smeared over what's already done and they had to stop painting further. It took years and years, but eventually they managed to finish it. And it has a very unique view. I can only recommend everyone who listens to it to Google the mural Battle of Cable Street, because it's like a fisheye perspective. You know, if you have like a camera lens that you look through and you see the events unfold in front of you. And that was the original idea of the artist that is still there today. And then it was there. And then again, a few years later in the 80s, there were some right-wing activists that smear, you know, like they put paint on it and try to destroy it. But it was always restored again. And today it's in really good condition.
Mm. And I guess murals and graffitis in general are kind of very political form of art, right? That also you can find everywhere in London. I mean, most most famously Banksy today is very critical, or Bambi. By the way, you should know that as a former employee of the Swiss Embassy, that the Swiss Embassy has some Banksys in the garage, don't they? And are we even allowed to say that, or is it secret?
Yeah, I think it's a secret, but maybe not so well kept. Yeah, there are some Banksys in the Swiss Embassy somewhere, but they're sadly not publicly accessible.
So you really have to become friends with a member of staff or with the ambassador himself if you want to access those paintings. I've never seen them. I was once invited to an event, but I couldn't go that day. I'm sure you know that.
Yeah. This was every morning and evening I saw it, because that's where the bicycles were stored. So I always cycled in the morning past the Banksy graffitis. It was pretty amazing. And but luckily, it's you can see so many Banksy, but also so many other street arts all around London, especially in the East End. There's a vibrant community. You can take tours, street art tours around. And maybe the last thing I want to say about the mural, before we pass on to our next stop on Cable Street, is that I have a particular connection to it because that person that I mentioned earlier, Dan Jones, who had the idea to put that mural up, also made a painting, a drawing that is in my house, in our living room. I'm looking at it now, actually.
Oh, wow. What is on it?
It's the market of the Whitechapel Market that is very near the Cable Street, also in the East End. And I love that place, and it's so nice to have that in our living room as well. You also want to show me a historically significant place, but this time it's a church, right? Or a mural?
Well, it's not really a church, but it's a place or a location that is very significant for the church and particularly for women's ministry in Britain. Because as most people probably know, that women's ministry is one of the most debated and controversial topics in church. Not every church agrees with women's ministry, that they can become priests like men. And in some churches, it's simply unthinkable. If you think of the Roman Catholic Church, although I feel there is maybe some opening going up there, definitely in the Orthodox Church, it's unthinkable. And also quite a few Protestant churches in some countries in Europe don't ordain women today. But I mean, so there is a whole history behind it. And why that mural or the area around the mural is significant is because the very first woman who was ever ordained into a mainstream church in Britain started her ministry there. So just in the streets behind, now they're all council flats, I think, and there is no church left. And that woman was called Constance Coleman. In church history, a very important name, but I don't think many people would have heard of her. And her husband, Claude, and they were both ordained on the same day. And that was the 17th of September, 1917. And it was also the day just before their wedding.
Wow.
So, what a week or weekend if you have your ordination and then the next day your wedding. She was ordained into the Congregational Church. There are not many left. It's a Protestant denomination, the Congregational Church. Mm-hmm. And there are not many left because over 40 years ago, two of the churches in Britain, the Congregational Church and the Presbyterian Church, they merged and became the United Reformed Church. And that's kind of the Swiss, the kind of the sister church of the Swiss Protestant Church. And there are only some very few of those congregational churches left in Britain. And that's the one who refused to join the union in the 1970s. So they're a bit quite revolutionary, I guess. They wanted to keep their identity.
And that must have been quite an amazing thing to become the first female priest in that time. Who is this person, Constance Coleman? What can you tell us about her?
I'm actually not quite sure how amazing that really was. I mean, looking back, of course, in history, it's certainly a great achievement, but I think it must have been a very hard time for her as well. I think pioneering is always a bit of both. It's a struggle and it's an achievement. Constance Bourne Todd was born in 1889, and she grew up in another part of East London, in Putney. And she had parents who always encouraged her to use her gifts. And her mother actually was one of the first generation of women who studied medicine. And so Constance, she was brought up in that other church, not the Congregational, but the Presbyterian Church, but they were very reluctant, actually very unsympathetic to women's ordination. And that was the reason why she swapped church. She became a Congregationalist in order to following her calling and become a woman of the cloth. And interestingly, quite a few of the first women to be ordained in that church were from a different church, Methodist, Anglican or Presbyterian church. And they changed denomination because they wanted to become ministers.
Right.
Constance was very active as well as a suffragette, and she learned Swedish to support the struggle of women's ordination in the Church of Sweden in 1950. So she also used her pioneer role for churches in other countries to support them.
So she was an activist?
Yeah, I think she was an activist. I think that'd be fair to say. Yeah. And as actually as many other women as well, she shared in the beginning, definitely, she shared her ministry with her husband, Claude, who was also a minister, and they lived on her salary. And it was, I think it must have been a very difficult first ministry, because it was when they started there, in that area around Cable Street, it was the end of the First World War. And that was really the whole area was like, they were surrounded by poverty and destruction. And they also had a very small salary. Very often women ministers were sent to churches that financially struggled because their salaries were lower and they couldn't afford a man. And I think that was very much true for Constance. So it must have been a real struggle. So that's Constance Coleman, the first ordained woman minister in Britain.
And who was the first in Switzerland?
Constance's counterpart. Actually, an image of Constance's counterpart, it hangs in my office in the church, a small picture of her on skis. And her name was Grete Capretz-Roffler. She's also quite well known also because it was just been a celebration about her recently and about women's ordination. But it's actually not very straightforward to answer that question about the counterpart in Switzerland, because there is a thing in the Protestant church in Switzerland that there is a difference between the ordination that makes you a referent, so the kind of the theological act of ordination. And then you are, as a second part, you're called into the church service. And that would allow you to be elected as a minister into a parish and to lead the parish. And so women were ordained in Switzerland as early as 1917 in the canton of Zurich. So that was around the time of Constance's ordination. But it was not before the 1960s that the first canton churches also allowed the election of women to lead a parish. So you can, I mean, it's a weird thing to think. You ordain women, but they're not allowed to lead a parish. But that was the case for over 50 years.
Well, I'm not surprised, given Switzerland's history with women's voting rights, for example.
Yes, absolutely. See, and you can see that very well reflected as well in the history of women's ministry. It goes hand in hand with the political developments.
So they were not allowed to lead a parish, but they were allowed to have a sermon. What can you do as a minister when you're not a...
If you can't lead a parish, yeah, yeah.
No, when you're a reverend but not a minister.
Yeah, so they were ordained, and they could be assistant ministers to their male colleagues, although they had exactly the same training, exactly the same ordination, but they had to assist for a long, long time. And that changed in the 1960s, but only under the condition that only unmarried women could become ministers, because the combination of housewife, mother and minister, that was believed to be irreconcilable at the time. And only since the 80s we have exactly the same rights, as in you can also be married and you can have a family and you can be a full-time minister.
And what about Grete that you mentioned earlier? She was a minister, a reverend, both?
So Grete, that's a very special story, because that is actually, it's kind of illegal what happened with her, but she was the first woman ever to lead a parish church in the canton of Grisons. But as in all the other cantons, she wasn't allowed to lead a parish. But she didn't live in that village, but she was called by the village of Furna, which is a really small mountain village. I think it's somewhere up from like Shields, go up the mountains. And she was called to be the minister by the congregation in that church in 1931, so well before that was allowed. And it's just because they knew her, they knew her. And the ministry was vacant for a while. And the canton church, they suggested a male minister, and they really didn't want that minister. So they just went on and said, you know what, we just appoint Grete. We have some savings, we can pay her a salary, we do what we want. So it was kind of an illegal action to do. And Grete was there for a while, and it was accepted for a while by the canton of Grisons. But I think after a few years, I don't know how many years she was a minister there, they axed the funding for the Church of Furna, and that forced Grete then to leave. So she was the first kind of illegal minister of Switzerland.
And once again, I like the Swiss history of democracy came through that they actually, the people wanted her.
That's true, yeah.
And that's why, so it was a rebel, it was like a grassroots rebel movement until it was then stopped by the cantonal church.
Yeah. But then as well, I mean, of course, it also has to consider that that village of Furna, it was also a bit an empty because they didn't like the minister that was suggested to them. And of course, you also have to ask the question, if it had been a woman minister they didn't know from childhood, would they have been favourable as well to women ministry? So I think there are kind of different factors that come together there. But definitely, they did what they wanted, that's for sure.
And I'm sure that was an important moment where she could pave the way and show that, you know, that a woman can be a minister and lead a congregation as well. What happened to her then after she was forced to leave that village?
It's actually a bit sad what happened to her afterwards in a way, because she was a really passionate minister. I think she was really called to do ministry, and she apparently was a very good preacher and she did a lot of innovations as well as a church leader. But once the ministry in Furna came to an end, and because it wasn't yet possible in the rest of Switzerland, anywhere in Switzerland, she couldn't go on to lead another ministry. And then her husband, who was an engineer, he went down the path of ordained ministry. So they could continue to serve the church as ministers, but under his name. And Grete was hoping that she could then, as a minister's wife, continue to preach wherever he would be called as a minister. It didn't quite work out like that. They were for a long time. He was the minister in Kilchberg near Zurich. And Grete was hoping that she could continue to preach there, but the congregation didn't really want that. So she was kind of blocked out. And her husband didn't really like the job. So you had this woman who was a really passionate and a really brilliant minister. And you had that engineer husband who really didn't like the job, but he was the one who preached on Sundays. And she wrote his sermons. You know, most of his sermons was actually her ghostwriting. And her role was then to, kind of condemned to run a household and to raise the children. And one of her grandchildren wrote a book about her, and it also turned out that, you know, some parts of that family life were really difficult because she was very unsatisfied. That was not easy for her to be restricted to that role of housewife and raising the children. So that book is actually really also reflects those parts of her story. And she was then only very rarely allowed to preach in some parish churches. So it's,
sad.
Yeah, it's sad. It's sad. And if you think, it still happens in so many churches, like, you know, Catholic women who would be brilliant and passionate ministers or priests, and they're just not, it's just not possible for them to go that way. It's very sad. However, at the Church of Kilchberg, where Jan Capretz ministered, with Grete watching from the margins, women ministers are no longer an exception, quite the opposite. The Church of Kilchberg is today led by one of the most prolific and well-known ministers in the Reformed Church of Switzerland, Reverend Sibylle Foron. Like many of us, she is forever grateful to pioneers like Grete who have paved the way for future generations, as she now tells us in her own words.
Grüezi miteinander, mein Name ist Sibylle Foron und ich bin Pfarrerin in Kilchberg, also der Gemeinde, wo Grete Capretz-Roffler mit ihrem Mann gewirkt hat, respektive als Pfarrer hat ja eigentlich nur er dürfen wirken. Ich bin Frauen wie der Grete Capretz-Roffler unglaublich dankbar, dass ich heute in Kilchberg in der Kirchengemeinde als Pfarrerin, und zwar in jedem Bereich, darf wirken, dass es für unsere Gemeinde hier in Kilchberg gar nichts mehr ungewöhnlich ist, wenn eine Frau auf der Kanzel steht. Schön, dass wir mittlerweile so weit sind. Jetzt müsste es nur auch noch eine gleichberechtigte Verteilung zwischen Männern und Frauen in den entsprechenden Leitungsgremien von unserer Kirche haben. In der Kirche auf dem Berg, das ist ja die Namensgeberin von Kilchberg, die Kirche auf dem Berg, ist es aber jetzt doch schon seit einigen Jahrzehnten Usus, dass eine Frau auf der Kanzel steht.
So we come to this week's question to the vicar. And the listener wants to know from you, Carla, what stigma attached to the vicar profession annoys you most? And specifically, which stigma relates to being a woman in this profession?
I guess it's quite a long list of stigmata attached to the profession of a vicar. That's a difficult choice. I think it's probably the one that annoys me most is if people think of vicars and generally of people of faith as naive, and that we disregard science or scientific knowledge and just think we're a bit stupid. I think that's for me really, really annoying, because I think it's exactly the opposite. You know, for me, it's faith broadens the mind. It's like, it's just a different view. And I do not disregard in any way the views of other religions or of science or of any other explanations how to see the world. And then there is maybe another stigma as well, and that's that some people just think that vicars have to be flawless and have to be some kind of superhumans. And that is also there's a difficult stigma to deal with, I guess, because there's also some truth in that. Obviously, we preach certain moral standards. We represent an institution, and also people entrust their, you know, their stories and sometimes quite intimate stories to us. And so in a certain way, it's okay that we are measured by different standards, definitely. But at the same time, when we're just expected to be superhumans and never mistake, then that's very annoying, because I think every vicar, or most vicars, hopefully, are very aware of their place in creation, and that we are human and we are not superhuman or God. So I guess that, like, seeing faith as naive and thinking of vicars as being particularly flawless, that's maybe the most annoying ones.
But it's probably also because people look up to you as role models, and...
I think so. As I said, I think there's also, like, a justification in that. And I think we have to really, you know, watch what we do, and also, like, the trust that people have in us, that it's right that we may be measured by other standards to a certain extent.
So that was two stigmata. Do you have also some maybe more light-hearted stigmas?
Yeah, there is actually one that I quite like, one stigma, and that's people who would think we're, like, really healthy and considerate and don't party and, you know, very behaved. And that's a good one, because you can really surprise people. So, you know, you're the cool vicar if you go to the bar and order a pint or two or three and you stay up till late. And it's just like, you know, for me, it's just a normal thing to do, because that's who I am. But it's really nice to surprise people that way, and in a really nice way. So I like that stigma, because I definitely like a pint in the pub every now and then, as you know.
I can confirm. Yeah, we've been to the pub together. Maybe we'll even record one episode in a pub one day.
I think we'll definitely do that. It's been on our list for a long time.
And what about the second question, second part of the question, as I'm the guardian of the listener's questions? The listener also wanted to know what your, were there specific stigmata attached to you being a woman in the vicar profession?
Yeah, there are particular ones attached to my gender, definitely. And I would say, in the first year when I trained as a vicar, so your vicar training, you're in a parish and you're being trained by a minister. I found it mainly annoying, the whole fuss about my gender in a male-dominated field. Although in the Protestant churches in Switzerland, it's, you know, fairly balanced now, women and men. But church generally worldwide is a very male business. But then there was a turning point. There was one church service where I presided communion alongside two ministers, a Catholic and a Protestant minister.
Both the male?
Yeah, both male. Yeah, and I was there as, you know, the woman in that trio. And there was a woman in the congregation. She sent me a letter after that church service. And I just remember the words that she, for her, it was kind of a life-changing moment, and she felt deeply spiritual to see a woman presiding communion, and it lifted her self-worth as a woman to see that. That's the moment where I realized that my otherness, in a way, as a woman, my the other gender, in a way, maybe that's something that I should embrace at least sometimes. it can also, there are some moments where it's really annoying, and then it, when it has a bit more that reaction of, oh, you're a woman, oh, you can do that job, oh, you can actually do that job well, ah, oh, you can actually, as a woman, you do it quite well. I mean, that's just like a completely different matter, and that's just plain annoying. And yeah. But I mean, of course, I get that every now and then. And I guess it's also because for me, my gender is not very high on the list of attributes for my identity, if that makes sense. It's not the first thing I think about very strongly, you know, oh, I'm a woman. There are other things that shape me much more. And I think that's probably the first one is probably that I'm Swiss, because I live in Britain and I'm a Swiss migrant. And it just really made that much more, made me much more aware of my Swissness. And then I think another attribute is indeed my profession, being a vicar. That's another attribute that I feel like shapes my identity a lot. And then also my upbringing. The way I was brought up, my family, my parents, my siblings. I'm the middle one of three sisters. And I think that also shapes my identity and my personality a lot. And for me personally, gender is quite low on that list. What are your three? Do you know what your kind of attributes are that you identify most with?
That's such a big and interesting question. You know, what shapes your identity? What are the main components of it? I think it can change as well, to some extent. If I think, echoing what you said before, you know, living in another country makes you think more about where you come from. And I would say, yes, Swiss, of course, but also actually in the UK, I particularly realized that it's about, we are European for British people, because they consider themselves on an island and we are on the continent. So I definitely felt much more, I've never felt more European than here. And it's things like, you know, I've definitely heard this phrase before, oh, you look very European, or the way you dress is very European, or your English is like European English, you know, sort of that continental accent that we have. And another funny thing is, when people go on holiday, or when I go to Switzerland, they say, ah, where are you going? Ah, you're going to Europe.
Yeah, you're going to Europe because you're going to France, right? Yeah, I know that one. Europe is one big melting pot.
It is. And the UK is not part of it, it seems. So I've definitely become much more aware of that, and sort of also, I think, embraced it much more. So I remember on Brexit night, when in early 2020, the UK left the European Union, I was very sad, because I think it's part of, even though Switzerland is not part of the European Union, I think I have this European identity that's become stronger now as well, being here. So that's definitely one of the components. I think another one that I've definitely thought more about recently was being white, because growing up in Switzerland in school, rarely talked or thought about ethnicity or the color of my skin. But in the UK, it's definitely a bigger topic, for sure. And in the last few months with Black Lives Matter and everything that's been going on around the globe, I've questioned myself more and tried to be more critical about that part of my identity, thinking what it means, and also, you know, the uncomfortable parts, thinking about where that privilege comes from. In a sense, your privilege always comes at the expense or at the price of someone else, and the different experiences that I have as a white person walking around London, for example, feeling safe, you know, not being afraid of the police, for example, or the way you've been dressed at work or in other places. So there's a lot of components of that whiteness that I think is really worth thinking about.
Yeah, and I think it's definitely, it's something recent that we really start to think much more about it. I completely agree with you. It's interesting because we really don't think about Definitely, I don't think about my skin color.
That's the point of the privilege.
Yeah, that's exactly is the why privilege. And I become now more aware of it because it's been talked about. And because actually recently I also started to review my reading list and my, you know, what I watch on television. And it's like until 2 years ago, it was very white. And I started to change that in recent years. But that's the whole thing, right? It's just, I think the arts can really change your mindset as well. But exactly, it's that not having to think about the color of your skin is the white privilege.
So, absolutely. And I think that diversity in what you read, what you listen to, including podcasts as well, you know, what you watch, who you talk to, has such a big impact. Definitely something that, yeah, that we, what you said that I should do and try to do more often as well, to question ourselves of what we consume and who, you know, who are we consuming knowledge and art from.
So you're Swiss, continental, European, and your whiteness, and is there another attribute that you that defines you?
Maybe also in the family that I'm with, that I was always the oldest one. I'm the oldest of my brothers, I'm the oldest of all my cousins. And I think another aspect is also being a man, and like you said, you know, being three brothers at home, having that upbringing, and I, similar to the whiteness, there's of course a question of privilege, and it's a part of me that I try every day to be conscious of and to think about the way I act. You know, when you're in a group conversation, for example, that you don't speak over somebody else, specifically if it's a woman, just because I've got the deeper, louder voice maybe. And yeah, I think that's something I think about a lot, and that is definitely part of my identity as well.
I think it's great that you choose that also. In a way, it's almost a deliberate choice, isn't it, to think about that, like male and white privilege as part of your identity, because I think that's really what was very often missing. And in a way, finding it also interesting that I don't put the gender on my list, or not high on my list, because usually yeah. It would be the other way around, that I'm much more aware of my gender as a woman, and actually yeah. It plays less of a role. But maybe I just must say as well that I, you know, I am very aware of gender inequalities. I'm a feminist. I read a lot of women's literature, of feminist literature, and I'm very aware politically that that there is a massive inequality. And just because personally, I just don't put that so high up. I know that experiences for women compared to men, obviously, in the world are very, very different. And I feel very passionate about that. But it's kind of the one thing is a bit more maybe political, and the other one on a personal level, it's a bit lower maybe on my priority list. But still, I do get into those situations when for someone it seems to be really important that I'm a woman. And I'm just like, oh no, I don't want this right now in this moment. It's not about me being a woman, but it is, and it can be annoying. Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's difficult to sometimes also separate personal and the person into political, or the personal is also political. But I think when it comes to identity, it's our choice. We can try to define who we are.
I think it's really what I take away from you as well today is that you can also be deliberate about the choices, what shapes your identity, and the things that, because you are part of a privilege, doesn't mean that you shouldn't make that a very deliberate choice of including that in your identity, and what shapes it as a deliberate choice. So I definitely take that away from today.
Yeah. Same for me. I mean, I'm trying to learn more and do more every day, but there's still so much that I feel like I'm unaware of, or it's an endless learning process, I feel like.
And now for some music from our brilliant organist, Peter Yardley-Jones.
flap.